Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host, guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. There are a few people in Washington these days who are thinking more seriously and engaging more constructively on a whole panoply of aspects of this war for the free world than the guest we have, I'm very pleased to say, for a full hour today. He is Clifford May, the president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a terrific organization in Washington. He is a man who brings a lot of skills to the topic, including as a very accomplished journalist, including with the New York Times. He has been a communications czar at the Republican National Committee. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Henry Jackson Society, one of my favorites. He also writes a very important column each week at the Washington Times, among other outlets. Cliff May, welcome. It's great to have a chance to talk with you at length about the state of the war of the free world in which you participate so effectively.
Well, thanks very much, Frank. Always good to be with you.
I'd like to start with the topic that many of us are focused on very, I think, sort of reflexively and tightly, namely this outfit that goes by various names. I guess at the moment they're calling themselves the Islamic State or the Caliphate, but it's also been known as ISIS and ISIL and so on. Talk a little bit, Cliff, about the nature of that particular group and whether it is proper for us to be so preoccupied with it at the moment.
One thing I'd say about it is that it's an expression of what I like to call jihadism, and I think that's a term they wouldn't reject, an expression of jihadism that's quite red in tooth and nail. It is led by a man who calls himself Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and has declared himself to be the caliph. And caliph implies ruler. It also implies that he is a successor of Muhammad. He follows only Sharia law as he interprets it, which means doing such things as cutting the heads off infidels like James Foley and killing Yazidis, who are ancient religious minority, because they are infidels, unbelievers. They are perhaps given a choice to convert or die. Wiping out Christians as well. People say, oh, but those are people of the book. Deny they should be protected. That's not quite how he sees it. So it's good for people to understand what jihadism means in this very clear form. They originated as al-Qaeda in Iraq. They've developed over the years since for various reasons, and they broke with al-Qaeda, and you hear a lot of commentators saying, well, that's because they're more extreme than al-Qaeda. That's not quite true. I think what bothers Ayman al-Zawahiri, who inherited the mantle of head of al-Qaeda from Osama bin Laden, is their declaration of a caliphate. He would think that's premature, what Lenin would call adventuristic. Why? Because should it be destroyed in this incarnation, faith in the inevitability of the rise of a caliphate again will be shaken, and Ayman al-Zawahiri doesn't see that, but it's not as though Ayman al-Zawahiri is a much more merciful jihadist leader.
Or has any differences about the objectives of this jihadism, and maybe, like Mafia Dons, has a preference for being the Don himself, the Uber Don, but basically is of a mind as to what they're about, right?
I think that's exactly right. I think it's an important and good way to see it, as if you're in the FBI and, you know, just the Corleones are fighting the Gambinos or whatever, you don't say, ah, well, which one is the more moderate of these? No, you understand that even though they fight among themselves, and they will because they are often rivals, they all represent the same thing. In the case of the mafia, it's organized crime. In the case of jihadists, it's the eventual domination, defeat and domination of the what they see as the Zionist crusader conspiracy, the Judeo-Christian world, the West writ large. That's what they're all about, even though they may have different strategies for how best to accomplish that aim. And so one of the challenges we face that I don't think is we are facing is that as we fight the Islamic State, and we should, we also should recognize that the Islamic Republic of Iran is every bit as jihadist, even though it sees the Islamic State as a very dangerous rival, even though they will kill each other with great glee, and both will shout Allahu Akbar as they do so.
Yeah, I want to come back to Iran at some length with you, Cliff, because you've done some really important work at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies on educating the rest of us about the threat that Iran represents and countering it. But before we leave sort of this macro picture for a moment, talk a little bit about something you alluded to in connection with al-Baghdadi's sort of driving impetus, which he would call, probably more than jihadism, Sharia, and the objective of imposing it worldwide. This, as we've been discussing, is a widely held ideological justification and driver for these groups, from the Taliban to Hezbollah to Hamas to Boko Haram to, you know, al-Shabaab, and on, the Muslim Brotherhood, not least. What's that about, Cliff, as you see it? Is it the case that this is somehow an extremist ideology that is unrelated to Islam, or is there more of a connection there than we've been led to believe?
This is very complex, and of course, this is very controversial. I'll say it the way I understand it. And that is to say that, of course, these people are extremists, but no, you cannot say it's not connected with Islam. You cannot say these people are heretics. You can say they are fundamentalists. There is absolutely a scriptural basis for what they're saying, and what they're saying is that it is our religious obligation to fight a jihad, to fight that there is a war that is taking place that is divinely endorsed, a war between the Dar al-Islam, the world in which Muslims rule, and the Dar al-Harb, which is by definition a realm that must remain under attack. The Dar al-Islam must defeat the Dar al-Harb. Sharia must be established. We're talking about God's law. It is meant to be established everywhere in the world. Man's law cannot substitute for the law of Allah. And it is our job as Muslims to do what we are called upon to do, to wage jihad, to establish Sharia, to establish dominance, to see to it that in the future, throughout the world, there is only one religion, that it is the true religion, that it is our religion, that it is Islam. Now, that said, there are, and this always has to be added, and it's important, there are many Muslims who want nothing to do with any of this. There are many Muslims who would say, look, that may have been absolutely the right course in the 7th century or the 8th century, the 9th century. Fighting jihad with a sword is one thing. Fighting jihad with chemical weapons or nuclear weapons, I see as another. I don't think the Quran actually took into account what it would mean to fight with nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. I think it's time we got along with others. Maybe we should try to convert them. Maybe that's not important to do. Maybe they'll try to convert us. We probably won't accept it. But I don't go along with these jihadis. Nonetheless, you cannot say that faith is not at the root of what these people are doing. The Ayatollah Khomeini, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leaders of Hamas, the leaders of Hezbollah, such as Nasrallah, these are, I'm sorry to say, men of faith, men of religion. And we have to understand that in all its complexity if we are to come up with strategies to deal with it that are effective. We can't simply say it's violent extremism, it has nothing to do with Islam, we need to have overseas contingency operations. No, we have arising from within the Islamic world, as we have come to call it, these very toxic ideologies that are derived from the Quran and from Islam. We hope that Muslims will reject them in these many various terrible and dangerous forms that they now exist. But we have to also look at them with clear eyes.
Boy, I think that was very brilliantly and accurately described, Cliff, and I thank you for that, not least because I think the point you've made about the distinction between a lot of Muslims who don't want to live under Sharia, who don't follow it themselves, who don't want to force everybody else to submit to it, are probably natural allies if they can be brought to the fight by their own impetuses or perhaps by our engaging with them against our common enemy, people who view them as apostates, people who view them as people who are deviating from the true faith. Every bit as much, therefore, in jeopardy as are we. We're going to talk more with Cliff May about this phenomenon of global jihadism and how it is playing out in other parts of the world, including vis-a-vis Israel, as Hamas attacks from Gaza. That and much more with Cliff May, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Clifford May, the founder and president of a terrific organization in Washington, D.C., the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He has been a foreign correspondent with the New York Times. He is a communicator by both profession and extraordinary skill. And we're visiting with him for this full hour of a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. Cliff, again, thank you for joining us. We've been talking a bit about the context of this global jihad. I want to just ask you, if you would, to address, if you would, the best way, if Congress is going to come up with a new authorization for the use of military force, which seems to be in the offing, against ISIS, against this jihadist enterprise there in Iraq and Syria. How would you recommend that, you know, authorization be characterized? What's the purpose? What's the need?
I would argue that it should be made as broad as possible. That, as you and I have been discussing, the battle for the war, the global conflict, is against jihadism, is against Islamism, is against those who are trying to force their interpretation of a particular religion on the world through various violent means. And an authorization for the use of military force should be broadly written so that we can fight against any of these groups. If for some reason we want to use a drone against Boko Haram, I think that should be well within the president's authority. He shouldn't have to say, you know, I think in Abuja in Nigeria, we have an ambassador and he might be in danger somehow. So therefore, no, he should be able to say, I understand that. We understand that there is a network of dangerous people whose central imperative is Islamic supremacy and domination, and we're going to fight them. We're going to have a strategy to fight them, and we're going to eventually defeat them. That's what I think we should be doing. I guess it was on Thursday this week, President Obama acknowledged that there was no strategy to defeat the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I think you and I would argue that there is no coherent strategy on the part of this administration to fight Islamism, jihadism, call it what you will, anywhere else in the world, or to deal with threats posed by Russia.
Or, yes, just about anything else. Exactly right. Cliff May, we're talking about the fact that we don't seem to have a strategy yet vis-a-vis the Islamic State, or as you say, I think this larger jihadist enterprise animated, I believe, by Sharia. And I couldn't agree with you more. This ought to be a mandate, if Congress is going to give the president one, to fight those who have declared war against us. And as you know so well, been at it at least since 1979, when the Iranians first started attacking us. Cliff, you've worked so long and so hard on this Iraq story and trying to have it come out rather better than it has. It must break your heart, as it does mine, to see what's become of Iraq since the president decided unilaterally to withdraw U.S. forces there. Do you fear that, given the nature of this global jihadist enterprise, as you've described it, that we're likely to see similar bad results if he does the same thing in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I mean, what history, I think, teaches on us, certainly modern history, is that wars are not over when the fighting stops. If we had left South Korea at the end of the Korean War and bugged out, left not a soldier there, no question that the North Koreans or the Chinese would have revived themselves and eventually attacked again. But we had stayed there not just for a few years, we're still there. And as a result, we're buying Hyundais now, and North and South Koreans are doing well while North Koreans are starving to death. At the end of World War II, if we had simply left Europe, there would have been a Nazi revival. We stayed. We worked on denazification. We worked on knocking down the small pockets of Nazi and neo-Nazi insurgents. We're still in Europe. In Japan, militarism might well have come back. Had we not stayed in Japan and worked with the Japanese, who wanted a different sort of a future, and that's been a successful effort. You cannot for us after the surge to leave Iraq without any residual force, pretty much guaranteed that. And what has happened would happen, and plenty of people, I think yourself included, predicted that. And the same is going to be true in Afghanistan. It may be that Afghanistan was not the battlefield to focus on, as President Obama told us it was. I don't think you need to fight on every battlefield. The very concept of having a strategy means you decide we need this battlefield we need to win on, this one we don't. You must establish priorities. That's what fighting a war is all about. You know that from your Pentagon days. What you do in the Pentagon is you plan, and planning a strategy means prioritizing, and we have not done that. And I don't think the president's decision to reinforce Afghanistan and bug out of Iraq was coherent from a strategic point of view.
Well, and now being compounded by bugging out of Afghanistan as well. And as you say, Cliff, you know, the essence of strategy is you have some clarity about who the enemy is, from whence you develop a means of countering that enemy. And that's missing altogether. And it's no surprise that we don't have a strategy in this and other areas. Cliff, let me quickly turn to yet another facet of the global jihadist enterprise, as you've described it so well, the Sharia adherent group seeking to destroy, first and foremost, but not exclusively, the Jewish state, Israel. Talk about Hamas and the advisability, as you see it, from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, of Israel trying to effect some kind of ceasefire that allows Hamas to live to fight another day.
Well, the first and most important thing is to recognize, and I'm afraid there are those who do not, that Hamas is absolutely a member of this jihadist network. Now, while it thinks globally, it acts locally. It is very intent on fighting only one set of infidels, and that is the Jewish state. They're an Israeli neighbors. The Hamas charter is jihadist. It is a Muslim Brotherhood charter. It is genocidal towards Israelis, but also towards Jews. It has not refuted that at all. And yet people think that Hamas is somehow the champion of resistance against occupation. Of course, Gaza has not been occupied since 2005. And the military blockade, which absolutely allows food, clothing, electricity, is supplied by Israel, fuel, all that has been going in all along. The Israelis have only tried to keep out weapons, not entirely successfully. I think that we can talk a lot about this most recent conflict and whether or not it should have ended when it did. There's quite a bit of controversy inside Israel. But the important thing is that Hamas in Gaza and wherever else it exists is absolutely an organization that's part of the jihad. It seeks to establish really not a Palestinian state so much as an Islamic emirate in Palestine with no infidels in any positions of power, and that emirate would eventually become part of a larger caliphate that Al-Qaeda wants to establish and that the Islamic State believes it is already establishing.
Yeah, and again, it just reinforces the earlier point that these guys are part of the enterprise, the larger jihadist enterprise. And I think their charter, if I'm not mistaken, is pretty clearly hostile to the United States as well. But Cliff, again, the thing that I'm vexed by, and I'm sure you are, and certainly our friends in Israel are, is that you've correctly said they've allowed food and medicine and, you know, other humanitarian assistance to migrate from Israel into Gaza. In the past, they also allowed concrete and construction materials, which it turns out, under Hamas, were used to build tunnels for the purpose of destroying kibbutzes and as many Israelis as they could, taking them hostages. God only knows what kind of mayhem they would have begun, perhaps in the course of the High Holy Days this fall, had there not been this attack. And Cliff, we're going to have to pause for just a moment, but when we come back, I'd like to get, again, your thoughts as to whether the controversy that is swirling in Israel should not also cause us to be supportive of Israel continuing this fight until, in fact, it has rooted out and hopefully destroyed this terrorist organization, this jihadist enterprise, the Muslim Brotherhood's franchise in the Palestinian areas. We'll talk about that and much more with Cliff May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and not least, how this fits into a Middle East that is currently increasingly aggressively jihadist, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. And even a president not given to truthfulness occasionally is candid. One such blue moon occurred yesterday when Barack Obama responded to questions about what his administration was going to do about the jihadist Islamic State in Iraq and Syria by saying, quote, "We don't have a strategy yet," unquote. Regrettably, the same applies to other unraveling international crises. We don't have a strategy yet for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or for China's increasing belligerence towards U.S. ships and aircraft and its neighbors in the Western Pacific. We don't have a strategy yet for our insecure borders and the threats coming across them, or for Iran's incipient thermonuclear menace. Worst of all, Mr. Obama seems to have no strategy for formulating any of these strategies. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to a very special conversation with an old friend and very valued colleague of mine, Clifford May, the president as well as the founder of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, an organization that since very shortly after 9/11 has really been at the forefront of thinking about and helping the rest of us develop strategies practical measures for protecting our country and other democracies against, among other things, the jihadist threat. Cliff, you've very nicely laid the table for us. Maybe just to finish this one thought about what should the Israelis be doing in the face of the prospect that it seems to me, at least, any reconstruction of Gaza that they enable or are induced to permit happening elsewhere, perhaps by an airport or a seaport being opened, is likely to wind up being used by this terrorist organization running Gaza in exactly the same way it has before, namely for the purposes of attacking Israel in the future.
Yes, and I do think, although there are certainly disagreements within Israel, I was there earlier this summer. I was in Jordan as well. There are disagreements. I do think they sort of agree on this part of it. which is that they like to see Hamas disarmed, but they know Hamas will not allow itself to be completely disarmed. What does that mean? That means that the Israelis will have to continue doing what they have been doing and probably do it better, and that is try to prevent the importation of missiles, other weaponry, the components for missile factories, and also try to prevent them from continuing to build tunnels with the material that's been supplied to them to build hospitals and schools and office buildings and other things that could be actually productive for the people of Gaza. They haven't been doing that. I think the Israelis will also need to develop, and I think they will, the technical means to recognize when tunnels are being built under their land. They haven't done that yet, but I think within a year, my guess is within a year, they will have done that, and that'll be another weapon that that Hamas will not find quite so easy to use. In a certain sense, this conflict in Gaza probably does amount to one more time mowing the lawn. It's not over. There are those who would like to bring it to an end. There are also those Israelis in very high positions who say, we have a lot of enemies. They just have to line up. I don't want to spend all my time worrying about Gaza. I don't want to reoccupy Gaza. I don't want to be responsible for Gaza. I have to worry about Hezbollah. I have to worry about the Islamic State. And most of all, I have to worry about Iran. We have to keep our priorities straight and not let our enemies decide what our priorities should be.
Just an aside, and then we'll move on. But one of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking, Cliff, these construction materials being used instead of tunnels for things like building hospitals and schools, which would benefit the people of Gaza. Unfortunately, as we saw very vividly in this recent conflict, the folks in Hamas are perfectly prepared to use those very humanitarian facilities as bases from which to attack Israel. It just makes this whole thing so maddeningly immune to
the That's right. They use mosques and schools to store weapons. They use hospitals as command and control centers. Their thought was quite right, is if the Israelis either won't attack us there and we'll be safe, or they will attack us, then we'll go to the media and then say to the media, look, they attack our hospitals. These people are monsters. And the media will say, yes, of course we'll report that. The media performance, the media performance in this last Gaza conflict was just shameful. I say that as a former foreign correspondent.
Well, and you wrote a very important column about this, Hamas Rules, you call it, Cliff. And maybe you could just spend a minute talking about that, because it has so dramatically compounded the problem that Israel faces with isolation and international condemnation, that these so-called independent monitors have really proven to be anything but.
Just to get a little more broad on this, journalism, I think, is in crisis right now. The most important conflicts in the world are conflicts against jihadis, and they essentially cannot be covered without fear or favor. You go into Iraq or Syria, even if you're reporting in a way that you would think is pleasing to the jihadis, they still may take you hostage because you're an American, and they may cut your head off. We've seen that with James Foley. There are others lined up to go. There could be 20 or 30 Americans, people not talking about it, journalists who are being held right now by these groups. In Gaza, it was very clear to me that you were never, ever seeing a picture of a Hamas combatant firing a rocket, firing a gun, nothing. You only saw pictures of rubble and screaming widows and children picking through the garbage. It was as if there was no conflict at all being waged from Gaza against Israel, as if they didn't start it. And you would hear on the BBC reports of the Israeli assault on Gaza, the offensive against Gaza. Not true at all. The Israelis, I can tell you, really did not want to be drawn into Gaza this summer. They couldn't help it. Hamas, with the missiles, with the kidnappings of children, with the tunnels, drew them in against their will. But the press could not report on this freely or fairly, because if you're in Gaza and you do not do what Hamas wants, your life will be in danger. There's intimidation and there's coercion. I am not asking the reporters in places like Gaza to be braver than they are. They're very brave. I'm asking them to be honest about the censorship, and they're not. What you see, there was a wonderful article on Tablet by Maddie Friedman saying that Israeli censorship is always mentioned, and there's very little of it, in reports from the Associated Press. Hamas censorship is never acknowledged.
Yeah, and just one other point. The degree to which the reporting also failed to recognize that when these civilian death counts were unveiled, at no point did anybody note that a very substantial portion of the so-called civilian casualties were military-age young men, which raises a real question as to whether they were, in fact, anything other than jihadist combatants. Cliff, let me turn quickly, because I do want to get on to one of the other things that you have done really incredibly important work on personally and as the head of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and that is Iran. Hamas has benefited from Iranian support over the years, of course, as have many others, Sunni as well as Shiite. Talk, Cliff, a little bit about where we are with respect to an incipient nuclear threat from Iran, the sanctions regime, the agreement that was supposed to prevent that from happening, and more broadly, the threat that Iran represents through terrorism and support for jihad more broadly.
I'm not optimistic at all. The Islamic Republic of Iran is a state devoted to jihad, devoted to spreading its version of Sharia around the world. It most immediately wants to be the hegemon, the supreme power in the Middle East, with clients, satraps, parts of its empire. In Iraq, for sure, at least in the Shia areas, it's having difficulty in the other areas because of the Sunni jihadists. Then, of course, moving over into Syria, where Assad is their governor general, their regent for the part of Syria he controls. They'd like to see him take the rest of it. It's why I think people like Rand Paul are wrong when they said we should support Assad because he's fighting against ISIS. Well, he is, but he's fighting for Iran. Lebanon, where Hezbollah dominates, and of course, Iran supports Hamas in Gaza as well. What the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, wants most are nuclear weapons. That'll be a game changer. That'll be a hinge moment in history. We use sanctions effectively to bring Iran to the table, but then Obama, I think, made a tremendously important mistake by relieving the pressure once the negotiations began rather than increasing the pressure and saying, we can and will crush, collapse your economy if we do not get a good result from these negotiations. Where we are now is, I think it's most likely, and General Michael Hayden has said this, I think, publicly, where the Iranian regime will pretend it is relinquishing its development of nuclear weapons, and the Obama administration and others will pretend to believe him. And what will happen is maybe there will be some delay of breakout capacity. Breakout capacity meaning the time at which they could have actually usable nuclear weapons, at least enough so that Obama can leave office saying the Iranians did not get nuclear capability under my administration. My legacy is firm, but the next president will have that happen, and it'll happen as a matter of agreement because of the sunset clause that they're negotiating into the agreement that essentially says a few years from now, we're going to treat Iran no differently than we treat Japan or Holland or any as a normal nation. We'll forget about the terrorism. We'll forget about its ambitions. We'll forget about the jihadism. We'll forget about all that. We'll allow them to have nuclear weapons soon. Now, it may be that Khamenei thinks, I don't want to wait 3 or 5 years. I'm not a young man. I want this in my lifetime. And he won't accept it. In a way, the greatest hope for the negotiations may be Khamenei and the fact that he's in a rush.
Well, or alternatively, we get the worst of both worlds, which is that they pretend only through part of the remainder of the Obama administration and decide to go fully nuclear, knowing that he won't do anything about it. Cliff, very important insights, needless to say, on the nature of the Iranian threat. When we come back in our final segment with Clifford May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, we'll pick up on the rest of the world and the threats coming from Russia, China, and beyond. Right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Any Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Any Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our final segment, alas, with Clifford May, the remarkable communicator, national security thinker, analyst, columnist, pundit, and think tank maven at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He has been giving us a marvelous tour d'horizon of the sorts of challenges that we're facing at the moment, notably but not exclusively from the global jihadists. And in this final segment, Cliff, I want to talk about two nations that are seemingly at least benefiting from, if not greatly encouraging, this jihadist turmoil and threats to us, if only because they have their own agendas that they'd like to see us distracted from. Namely, in the case of Russia, this Ukrainian business at the moment. In the case of China, we'll talk a little bit momentarily about what they're up to in the Western Pacific. But start with Russia. What is Vladimir Putin up to, and how serious a problem do you think it represents, not just for people in eastern Ukraine or Crimea or more broadly Ukraine, but for us?
Well, my reading of it is this, that Vladimir Putin believes, I think Russians believe as well, that Russia was a great power and should be a great power. I think Putin says, under the czars we had an empire, under the commissars we had an empire, under Vladimir Putin we will have nothing less. And so he has started that process. He started actually a few years ago in Georgia, took off a slice there. Nothing untoward happened to him. Now, then he went into Crimea. He saw that there was no real resistance against that. And now he's going to do whatever he thinks he wants to do in Ukraine. And we don't know how far he'll go. I think what we need to be very concerned about is where he might go next if he is successful here, as he's likely to be. I think he believes that, and we know he has said this, that the great tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think he believes that just revenge would be the collapse of NATO, and that he has the power to make that happen. How might he do that? He would invade a NATO country, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, perhaps, and see if NATO, as it is obligated to do, fights for those countries. If it does not, NATO is destroyed, and he's destroyed it, and I think it would be a very happy day for him.
Having rehabilitated the sort of Russian Empire and taken down the group that he considers to have been responsible for the unraveling of the Soviet Union. What I value so much about your thinking, Cliff, is you've really taken aboard the lessons of history, and we've seen this again and again in the past, where totalitarians have not been prevented from acting in this aggressive fashion, and it brings us to China, which is now very directly confronting not just Vietnam, not just the Philippines, not just Japan or Taiwan or South Korea, but us in some extraordinarily provocative ways, including interfering with our aircraft and ships in that region. The president has talked about a pivot to Asia. There's no evidence of that, as best I can tell. But are we on a collision course, do you think, with a new hegemon in the Far East?
Yeah, the pivot to Asia was a way of saying we don't want anything more to do with the Middle East, and didn't work out, nor have we done more in Asia. My reading is that China at this point does want to establish itself as the hegemon of the Middle East. Of Asia, doesn't really mind if Iran establishes itself as the hegemon of the Middle East. And in order to do that, China needs to diminish the United States. Doesn't need to destroy the United States. I'm not sure it's even intent on doing that. I think it probably isn't. It's a more pragmatic regime than those in places like Tehran. But diminishing the U.S., it sees as a useful endeavor, and it is beginning to do that, and it will continue to do that until such time as it sees the U.S. pushing back, which hasn't happened. I think for both China and Russia, there's an old saying, I think it's Leninist or Stalinist, that when you probe with your bayonet, if you hit steel, you retreat. But if you probe and it's mushy, you continue to move forward.
Yeah. This is an interesting topic for a much longer conversation than we can do justice to today. But my own concern is that, as Sun Tzu, the great Chinese strategist of thousands of years ago, held, you know, if you can defeat an enemy without having to go to war with them, that's preferable. But I think China is creating the option of going to war if they feel they need to. But certainly our defeat is unquestionably in their perspective. Let me turn at last to a topic that I know you've very, very closely considered and engaged upon, notably during your time as a communicator for the Republican National Committee, but subsequent to that, of course, as well. Part of the problem, it seems to me, part of the fact that we've gone for 5.5 years without a strategy to speak of, with the hollowing out of our military, with one feckless response after another to the various kinds of aggression that we've talked about, the jihadists, the Russians, the Chinese, and others, has been the lack of a real loyal opposition that is imbued with the kinds of principles and clarity and alternatives to this behavior that both would, I think, resonate with the American people and certainly serve us better as they have in the past. Peace through strength, of course, is what Ronald Reagan used to call it. Give us your thoughts on where the Republicans are at the moment and what needs to be done to reconstitute, really, a national loyal opposition imbued with that peace through strength philosophy.
Well, Republicans are fairly self-evidently divided, and they do not have a uniform or united position. I think you are exactly right that the foundation of it should be peace through strength. I think there are things on which Republicans can absolutely agree. One should be the strengthening of our military in a time of war rather than the weakening of our military in a time of war. Very hard to see how that represents good strategy. But you have people like Rand Paul who are essentially putting forward positions no different from what Obama is saying. I think actually Rand Paul may be saying it a little better, but he also says we don't really have dogs in most of these fights, and Assad doesn't look so bad to me. He may be a stabilizing force. Maybe we should support him, forgetting the fact that he is the client taking instruction and help and everything else from Iran and from Hezbollah. He doesn't seem to understand how this all connects. It's very hard to do this when you don't have a national leader, and you really don't at this moment for the Republican Party. You will when you have a presidential candidate, but I'm not sure who that is going to be. But I think, just to reiterate, you're right to say start with peace through strength and then think about what that means in all of our national security and foreign policies.
Yeah. And what is so vexing about this, I'm afraid, is that as long as there is kind of this siren song, nominally at least, within Republican circles from the libertarians, notably but not exclusively Rand Paul, that, you know, if we just leave everybody else alone, they'll leave us alone, that is appealing particularly, it seems, to some young people who, I guess, don't know any better, haven't been properly trained to understand that historically that does not work out. But I guess in closing, Cliff, if you had one word for the Republican leadership at the moment, such as it is, in the face of what Obama is doing to borders and to you know, our interest of the military and so on so many fronts, what would it be?
Well, it wouldn't just be Republicans, but I would say that beyond peace through strength, I would say that being good policy is prioritizing. You and I have discussed that in a number of contexts. That means that national security needs to be a priority. That means our defense policies, our energy policies, our immigration policies, and many other realms of policy need to reflect our intention of defeating those who call themselves our enemies, those who are devoted to waging war against us, those who are devoted to destroying us. Does that mean that climate change is not, as Secretary Kerry has said, the number one problem facing America today? Yeah, it actually does.
Yeah.
So we need to prioritize.
The defense of democracies. We would expect nothing less from you as president and founder of a foundation with that name. Cliff May, thank you for giving so generously of your time today and for all you do to really help all of us understand the challenges of our time and what we had best be about if we're to meet them and protect this country we love for our children and our grandchildren. I hope the rest of you have enjoyed this as much as I have and that you'll tune in again next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.